1974, Jensen versus Wisconsin Patients Compensation Fund. My notes show that Attorney O'Neill will argue first for 25 minutes or less for the Jensens. Mr. Curtis Swanson will argue 15 minutes for David McPherson, and Attorney Gutglass will argue for the Wisconsin Patients Compensation Fund for 15 minutes. Okay. And you have rebuttal time, Mr. O'Neill. Mr. O'Neill?
Thank you. Good morning, Chief Justice, Associate Justices. My name is Matthew O'Neill. I'm with Friedberg Finnerty in St. John, and I represent Attorney Lee Foreman and the Jensens, the appellants in this action. Co-counsel Shannon Allen is here at counsel table with me, and my client Lee Foreman is here in court today to watch the arguments. May it please the court. In Wisconsin, before a trial court can issue a contempt sanction of $50 against an attorney for being late for court, that attorney is entitled to notice of the sanction and an opportunity to respond to the sanction. We contend that an attorney admitted in Wisconsin for a single case while representing their clients in a pending action is entitled to those same basic procedural rights before that trial court can kick that lawyer out of the state by revoking his pro hoc vice admission, which results in the loss of a client for the attorney and results in the clients losing their counsel of choice. Now, the issue on this appeal, as opposed to the initial appeal heard this morning, is very narrow. It's limited to the question of whether an attorney, once admitted pro hoc vice in Wisconsin, has the right to notice in a hearing before that status is revoked by trial court. We are not concerned in this case with whether the conduct of Attorney Foreman warranted revocation of his pro hoc vice admission. We are also not concerned with whether Mr. Foreman was given notice and a meaningful opportunity to be heard, because the trial court, in an amicus brief filed in this action, has conceded there was no notice given to Attorney Foreman, there was no meaningful opportunity to respond given to Mr. Foreman with respect to the pro hoc vice revocation.
Mr. O'Neill, isn't there an issue raised in the briefs, however, in regard to that matter? Isn't the argument that's provided by the other side here that there was indeed an opportunity to be heard, and that opportunity was part and parcel of the hearing in regard to the this trial in this particular case?
Yes, the issue has been raised in the briefing by the defendants in this action. However, it was not raised in the Court of Appeals' limited order, which granted leave to appeal from the decision in this case. That order of the Court of Appeals was limited to whether there was right to notice in a hearing.
Well, let's assume that this court can hear that issue and decide that issue in any case. What is your response to the fact that there was apparently a hearing on the motion in regard to a mistrial?
Okay. Aside from the trial court's concession, the problem and the answer to that assertion that Mr. Foreman had notice in a hearing is that he did not have notice in a hearing with respect to his right to continue to represent his clients. What he did have notice of was the fact that there was a dispute about the testimony of this doctor. He did have notice that a mistrial was being requested. That was specifically asked after the lunch break for the first time by the attorney for the Wisconsin Patients Compensation Fund, I believe. He had notice of the issue on the mistrial. They had a brief argument about that, which could constitute a hearing given that it's a flexible process. But nowhere was it ever brought up that his status as the attorney for his clients was at risk. And the reason that's important is you're talking about two different standards. The standard for a mistrial is essentially contained within the inherent powers of the court, and they can declare a mistrial for whatever reason they see fit within their discretion to protect the interests of the clients, the court, the integrity of the proceedings. With respect to sanctions, which also came up at the end of this, there are set standards in Wisconsin law, but generally it's within the broad discretion of the trial court. However, with respect to revocation of pro hac vice, as this court has just finished discussing for an hour, there's a very specific Supreme Court rule that lays out standards. And those standards are, you are entitled to continue representing your client once admitted, unless the court makes a finding that you have manifested incompetence to represent your clients, or that you have shown an unwillingness to abide by the Code of Professional Responsibility or the rules of decorum of that court. Those standards were never brought up, were never discussed, and were never at issue in the proceedings on October 6th when the mistrial was declared in this case. And I think it's evident from the trial court's decision to participate in this matter as amicus, which it did not have to do, when it filed its brief, that there was no notice in the hearing. The language in their amicus brief says straight up, Attorney Foreman was not given notice that the circuit court was considering withdrawing permission for Attorney Foreman to continue to represent the Jensens pro hac vice, and he was not afforded an opportunity to be heard on the issue. I think the trial court's concession in that regard is binding in this case. However, if the court does reach it, I think it's clear from the record that there was absolutely no notice that his pro hac vice status was at issue. The basic facts of this case, and I will just go through them briefly just so...
What page did you just read from, Mr. O'Neill?
Page 8.
Page 8 of the amicus brief.
Thank you.
I'll just briefly go through the facts, if only to distinguish this case from the Philpula case, which was just heard. The dispute in this case arose on the third day of a medical malpractice trial and centered on whether a treating physician who was offering an expert opinion was giving an expert opinion that differed from the opinion he stated at his deposition. At his deposition, he indicated that it was very probable that the injury was related to some manipulation. At trial, he stated that the version was the most likely event that injured the spinal cord of the infant plaintiff. At the deposition, he was asked by the defendant's counsel whether he was willing to give his opinion to a reasonable degree of medical certainty, and he said he was not. At trial, he gave the opinion about it being the most likely event to that standard. There was an objection. There was a dispute about whether, number one, the defense counsel should have been informed that the doctor's opinion was changing. Number two, whether the doctor was improperly given materials after his deposition, and notice should have been given to the defendants about that. And there was a dispute, number three, about whether those actions violated the trial court's order, which stated that, with respect to experts, you had an obligation to give opposing counsel notice of any changing or developing opinions of experts. However, at trial, all that happened at the end of this discussion was a mistrial was declared and sanctions were imposed, and everybody went home. 1 week later, my client received in the mail an order from the trial court, sua sponte, which simply revoked his right to represent his client's pro hac vice and repeated the language of Rule 10.03 sub 4 without any further explanation as to what conduct it was could have resulted in that finding. The issue of whether notice and a hearing is required brings up two issues. The first one is whether it is required as a constitutional matter. The second one is whether it's required as a matter of state policy.
I interject another issue? And that was, as I understand, the amicus brief advocating that if the court would decide that a notice and hearing was required, they were required in this in this proceeding. The amicus is advancing the position that the court should remand for notice and hearing without reaching the merits of whether the court erroneously exercises discretion. So sometime during your argument, I'd like you to advance to address that sub-issue also.
Well, I'll address it right now, Justice Bradley. I agree that given the limited order of the Court of Appeals that accepted this case, that whether the trial court properly exercised its discretion when making the substantive decision is not at issue. It hasn't been briefed. I think if this court found it so obvious that he failed to exercise his discretion, it's within the court's powers to do so. But we haven't presented that argument. I don't believe it's been briefed by the opposing counsel. However, what the court asked for in its amicus brief is instructions as to what is required on remand, and I will address that now. Our contention is that this court, if it concludes that notice and hearing is required either as a constitutional matter or as a policy matter, should remand the case back with an order that the trial court, the original trial court judge Gibbs, give written notice to Attorney Foreman of precisely what conduct of Attorney Foreman is at issue, why that conduct violates Supreme Court Rule 10.03 sub 4, and then the case should be transferred to another judge to make the decision of whether, in fact, that conduct violates Supreme Court Rule 10.03 sub 4.
Why the transfer?
The transfer, I believe, is required because we're in a situation where this trial court has already made the decision. And if we are simply sent back to that court to get notice and a hearing, there will be an inherent bias, is an inherent bias, in that trial judge to make the same decision he's already made.
Well, but you have the difference between summary contempt and contempt it's not in the presence of the court. And if there's contempt in the presence of the court, and I'm analogizing, which may not be a perfect analogy, and you can attack it, between this and contempt, the judge who sat there provides for a contempt order right away, doesn't he or she?
I would concede and agree that in the ordinary case, this decision should be made by the trial court that has witnessed all of the conduct that's at issue. However, as in the case of Johnson versus Trueblood, the Third Circuit case that's cited in the briefs, given, number one, the fact that the court has already made a decision, and given the particular level of language that the court employed during the mistrial proceedings, including that the actions made the court sick, that it was reprehensible, that there was games playing, which was announced to the jury, I think similar to the case in Johnson versus Trueblood, that there requires a more neutral court to decide whether my client gets to continue representing his clients and whether they get to continue having their counsel of choice. And I would add a second reason that supports that argument, and that is Section 801.58 sub 7, which allows an attorney to automatically request substitution against a judge on remand if there's further proceedings. In this court's Findorf decision, issued this year, I believe, the court recognized that that was a legislative recognition of the inherent bias in a court being asked to reconsider and overturn a decision it already made.
Let me see. So if the judge had done this properly and given notice right away, then you would have the same judge. But because that didn't happen, then you're saying that you'd have the right of substitution.
Correct. We would have had the notice. It would have been the same judge. And before making a decision, my client would have been able to address it in a meaningful opportunity and bring up such facts as, these are his clients, they would like to continue with their attorney of choice, and he has not manifested incompetency. It could be a hearing on his general competency in this trial. It could be a hearing that involves When you talk about unwillingness to abide by the rules, whether that can be a single instance, which is all we're talking here, or whether you need repeated conduct that can violate that rule, it would have been an entirely different proceeding, and the judge would not have already made the decision. Our contention between the two ways that this court can go is that the court has to go with the decision that it is constitutionally required in Wisconsin to provide notice and hearing to an attorney before revoking pro hac vice status. The United States Supreme Court has only touched this issue once in Lice versus Flint, and what they held is you don't have a constitutional right to practice in any given state in which you're not admitted, and there is no right to notice and hearing with respect to denial of admission. However, every court to have been faced with this issue about what happens after you're admitted and whether you have that right to notice and hearing before revocation has agreed you have the right to notice and hearing. Some have reached it on constitutional grounds. Some have reached it as a matter of policy. In Wisconsin, it's properly considered a constitutional matter because of the limited property interest that arises once you are admitted to represent your clients.
What's the matter with notice from the bench? You say written notice, order with written notice, stating the conduct at issue. How much time do they have to give you?
Well, all of the law about notice in a hearing talks about that it's flexible and it has to adhere to the particular situation. In other words, there's no flat rule that written notice is required in X situation and oral notice is appropriate in other situations, but it's a case-by-case basis. Our contention is when the issue is as serious as a lawyer being taken away from his clients and the clients losing their counsel of choice, that this court can and should instruct that in order to comport properly with the notice required, it should be written notice. And a number of the courts that have addressed this particular issue have specifically required written notice. The property interests under United States Supreme Court law of Lice versus Flint, of Roth, of Logan versus Zimmerman, all points towards whether there is this bundle of rights or a legitimate claim of entitlement under state law. In Logan, it was indicated that the hallmark of property is an individual entitlement grounded in state law, which cannot be removed except for cause. Once an attorney is admitted pro hac vice in Wisconsin, he or she acquires a right to represent the client. He or she acquires a right to appear in Wisconsin courts and advance that case. And he or she acquires the right to continue representing that client until that for-cause standard set forth in Supreme Court Rule 10.03, sub 4, is met. And it is particularly that definition of how the discretion can be exercised that provides additional support for the recognition of this as a property right. This isn't simply the fact that the attorney obviously has a financial interest in this kind of a medical malpractice case, although that does weigh into the equation. It is, what rights does he have granted under Wisconsin law? And here, he's got the right to have a specific standard met before he can be kicked out of court here.
Counsel, I have not carefully read the Hawaii case, but that addressed the issue of, you know what you're talking about, the Kunimoto case.
Correct.
But when I did look at it yesterday, the Supreme Court of Hawaii found limited property right when attorney is admitted pro hac vice, and so said there was a due process violation, or potentially due process was implicated then, on the withdrawal. As I recall, they tied it to a specific rule or statute. In other words, that they that there was a limited property right pursuant to, I can't remember, 1.9 or something.
Correct.
Does your argument require that it be found in Wisconsin law someplace? I assume it does, and if so, where is that right?
Yes, it does require that it be found in Wisconsin law, and it was Rule 1.9 of Hawaii's state rules governing practice. And in Wisconsin, well, this is interesting, because in Hawaii, the rules simply allowed discretion for the trial court to admit the attorney to practice. And there wasn't anything further in the rule which defined how they could exercise discretion to revoke that status. However, the Hawaii Supreme Court found that as a matter of exercising their inherent powers, there were some limits on their discretion. In Wisconsin, the source of the property interest is the standard that's specifically set forth in the second sentence of Rule 10.03 sub 4 that does define a four-cause standard before the status can be revoked. And it's state law that creates a property interest, and it is particularly a four-cause requirement before you can have a right or entitlement. In this case, it's the right to represent the Jensens, before that can be taken away.
How does the establishment of a standard for a trial court's exercise of discretion establish a property right? This is a privilege. This is not a license.
Absolutely, it's a privilege.
How can you get a property right out of a privilege?
Because that's where property rights are established by state court rules, which give one a legitimate entitlement to certain rights and benefits, and when there is a four-cause standard created for the deprivation of that right, the right to represent his clients, it is that standard and that set of rules and that expectation that gives rise to the property interest. That's precisely what was held in Logan versus Zimmerman, where it was a question of whether you had a right to continue a cause of action, whether that could be taken away from you, and it was the fact that you had rights under the statute to pursue a cause of action that gave you the right not to have it taken away, which becomes a property right.
Oh, but that's a much different situation than this, isn't it? I mean, this statute establishes a privilege to practice, which is discretionary in the trial court, and really because this rule establishes a standard for the exercise of that discretion doesn't morph the privilege into an entitlement, does it?
Well, it doesn't morph. If I'm getting the particulars mixed up, I apologize, Justice Sykes. But what the entitlement is to continue representing the client until that specific standard is met. So you're right, it's a privilege to practice here. But once granted, you have a right to continue doing so unless somebody is going to stand up and say that you manifested incompetency or you're unwilling to abide by the rules of this court.
Are you arguing that that's a property right that belongs to the lawyer or to the client?
It belongs to the lawyer. Although courts have indicated that both the client and the lawyer having the same interest can advance, either one can advance the interest. But it is a property right of the lawyer.
How do they get the property right from the rule, 10 point whatever it was, 034?
Excuse me?
They get the property right, if your argument follows through, right from 10.34.
Yes.
Because it's a privilege to come in. Once the privilege is granted, the court has said you may keep that privilege unless blah happens.
Right. And if this court were to conclude that there were no property interests, certainly notice and a hearing should be required, as the Holman court found, as the Johnson court found, it should be found as a matter of public policy. Wisconsin lawyers, before you're disciplined, before you're sanctioned, before you're disqualified, are entitled to notice and a hearing. Supreme Court Rule 28.5 subjects out-of-state counsel to the same disciplinary authority of the state of Wisconsin. And concurrent with that policy, out-of-state lawyers should be also accorded the same basic procedural rights of fairness before they are subject to discipline under Rule 10.034.
Why aren't you advancing the argument that shouldn't have withdrawal on pro hoc vici, shouldn't be treated as a second-class lawyer, that if there's going to be any repercussions, and I use that word advisedly, it should be through the lawyer discipline system.
Well, I would disagree, and I wouldn't advance the argument that the court need go anywhere else than Supreme Court Rule 10.03 sub 4 to deal with a pro hoc vice issue and revocation. Whether the court decides to read into those standards the rules of professional responsibility, even if they do, I think that the discretion is still in the trial court and they don't need to go elsewhere to exercise that. I think that's what the rule intends. However, your point about the policy is correct. In the Johnson versus Trueblood case, where the Third Circuit declined to go to the constitutional route but said, we'll look at the policy, they identified a number of factors, including that it can be unfair and will not give an appearance of regularity if out-of-state counsel are treated differently with respect to procedural rights than in-state counsel are. And they also identified other policy interests which go in favor of giving notice and a hearing, which are you are protecting that attorney's reputation and making sure it's not unnecessarily harmed without first having notice and a hearing. You're protecting that attorney's livelihood and making sure that's not unnecessarily harmed, because as indicated from the defendants in the prior case, there would be arguments that that attorney, once thrown out of Wisconsin, can't come back in another case. And there are some states where the pro hoc vice laws, one of the specific criteria that is looked at is whether you've ever been, had your pro hoc vice taken away in another state.
Is there anything else in the law that a trial judge can do without notice and an opportunity to be heard, apart from maybe routine scheduling, rescheduling of things, that sort of thing, or an ex parte TRO to preserve the status quo pending a full hearing on a preliminary injunction? Is there any other category of thing that a circuit court can do without notice and an opportunity to be heard?
Not that I'm aware of offhand, and I think it points out the fundamental reason for notice and a hearing is it does add a level of integrity and fairness and trust in the system, that things aren't going to be handled, rights aren't going to be taken away, people's interests aren't going to be affected until they are given a meaningful opportunity to address whatever the concerns of the court are.
Thank you, Mr. O'Neill. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. We'll next hear from Mr. Swanson, representing David McPherson.
Thank you. My name is Curtis Swanson. I'm from the law firm of Axley Brunelson here in Madison, and I represent Dr. David McPherson. The first point I want to make is that Mr. O'Neill talked about Mr. Foreman's right to have a meaningful response to the issues raised by the court concerning his conduct. And this is a case where there was a fact-finding hearing relating to Mr. Foreman's conduct. That hearing went on for approximately an hour before the lunch break. There was an approximate hour and a half break during that time when Mr. Foreman had available to him his entire file to justify his actions to the court. And then we came back not for a brief discussion, but for, again, more meaningful argument.
Well, Mr. Swanson, what was the cause of this hearing? Why was this hearing called?
This was caused because a treating physician who had testified in his deposition that he had no opinions about cause to a reasonable medical probability other than manipulation sometime during the several days, and there were two manipulations, so it's important to understand that. He had no opinion to a reasonable medical probability. 3 weeks before the trial started, Mr. Foreman sent this treating physician more records and asked him to form an opinion, which he did and advised Mr. Foreman a week and a half before trial, and which Mr. Foreman never advised the court or the other attorneys, which was a violation of the pretrial order issued by the court.
Okay, so what was the notice given for this hearing? Was there notice?
There was notice on that day that we're going to have a hearing on this issue. It, as always occurs when you're in the middle of trial. We have a jury of 12 people or 14 people sitting there. It's not practical for a trial judge to say, I'm going to give you 2 weeks' notice or 2 days' notice. We have to deal with these issues now. And that's what the trial judge did.
This was a hearing on mistrial. Is that correct?
It was a hearing on what do we do. It was not noticed or talked about. The issue was we have a significant problem. This was a very damaging piece of evidence that came in against the defense over which we had no notice. Then the issue becomes, what do we do? And in fact, Mr. Foreman, before lunch, challenged the court to declare a mistrial and to assess costs against him, and only withdrew it after the defendants made a motion for mistrial. So as often happens in a trial setting, there is not a neat, we're going to give you notice of what's going on, and these are the issues. The issue was, we have a problem, we have a prejudice, and now we have to deal with it. And how are we going to deal with it?
How do you deal with the page 8 concession of the judge that Attorney Foreman was not given notice, but the circuit court was considering withdrawal permission for Attorney Foreman to continue to represent the Jensens pro hoc vice, and he was not afforded an opportunity to be heard on the issue of whether permission for him to represent the Jensens pro hoc vice should be withdrawn?
Number one, that attorney wasn't at the trial, all right? Number two is, the hearing covered all of the issues, that all of the factual issues about what the order is based upon.
Well, let me, if I may, I know the it's an assistant attorney general, so
sure.
Most likely wouldn't be at trial, but that response seems to divorce the attorney from his client. I read this brief filed, I mean, I'm reading it this way, filed on behalf of Judge Gibbs, that this is Judge Gibbs's position.
Yeah, and I to be honest with you, I don't know what communications went on. I will say this, that if you're asking me the question, and on that day, and during the hearing on the motion for mistrial, did Judge Gibbs say, I'm considering removing your pro hoc vice status? The answer is no, he did not. Was there discussion about everything that was formed the basis for the judge's decision? And was Mr. Foreman given multiple opportunities to explain his actions? The answer is yes, he was. And further proof of that is that within a week or two after the declaration of the motion for mistrial and the removal of his pro hoc vice status, Mr. Foreman filed a motion for reconsideration. And in his affidavit, he said, I was denied the opportunity to put in a certain letter and the deposition of Dr. Jacobson, which may have allowed the court to make a different decision. And in fact, the reality is, Mr. Foreman, during that hearing, submitted the letter that he had talked about in the affidavit, and there was significant discussion of the deposition of Dr. Jacobson. So that after the fact, when Mr. Foreman says, I didn't have the opportunity to present this evidence and it may have made a difference, the fact of the matter is, he had already given the judge this information.
Is there a material difference between the standard for granting or denying a mistrial and the standard for withdrawing pro hoc vice status?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think there, I think the facts, you may have to declare a mistrial if there is an inadvertent tainting of the juror. You may have, or if an attorney inadvertently violates an order, all right, which may not rise to the level of a withdrawal of pro hoc vice. None of that's in this case. Mr. Foreman has never said, "My God, you know, I never saw that order. I just, if I'd seen it, I would have revealed this information." There's never any argument that this was an inadvertent violation of a court order. All right, he has maintained the position, which I think is untenable, that that testimony that this is possible is substantially similar to testimony that this is probable, which turns the burden of proof on its head. So, in this case, I believe the factual setting that provided the basis for the mistrial clearly provides the basis for the judge to act upon that information. And had he given Mr. Foreman another opportunity, I don't think Mr. Foreman is allowed to open up the record and say, wait a minute, ignore what I said on the motion for mistrial, now here's my new story. All right? I think he is stuck with the factual setting, and all his only argument would be, well, yeah, I violated a court order, I sent this information to the doctor 3 weeks ahead of time, he told me a week and a half ahead of time, I didn't want to tell the other side, but that's not bad enough to have me lose my pro hoc vice status.
Mr. Swanson, isn't the rights of the client, the right and desire of the client to continue with the same counsel, an important factor for the trial court to look at in deciding whether or not to revoke?
I think that is going to always be in these cases. I mean, Mr. Foreman is there because they hired him. All right? If that trumps everything else, well, then people are going to be lining up to hire out-of-state attorneys pro hoc vice because they can violate court orders, and all I got to do is come in and say, but my right is to have this attorney there.
Well, is there anything in the record that would indicate that Judge Gibbs or Judge Carlson or both of them weighed that issue, looked at the rights of the client?
What I'm saying, I think you assume it's a given. If I'm here arguing today for Dr. McPherson, I think it's a given that Dr. McPherson wants me here arguing this case. And that would somebody withdraw or would somebody revoke my right to make this argument, that he would feel aggrieved. But the fact of the matter is, that fact alone should not trump inappropriate conduct. Because if it does, then there is no basis for the trial court to ever maintain control of its courtroom, which is what this judge was trying to do. Now, there have been discussions here this morning about whether or not a out-of-state attorney pro hoc vice or an in-state attorney are being treated differently. And the fact of the matter is they are different by their very nature. When I appear before Wisconsin courts, it's because I took a bar exam. All right, and that I have maintained my continuing legal education credits, and I do a lot of things to appear, to be able to appear before Wisconsin courts. An out-of-state attorney under pro hoc vice has no obligation to take the bar exam, has no obligation to go to one of the Wisconsin laws, has no obligation to meet Wisconsin standards as far as continuing legal education. So we aren't the same, all right? We're different. What the trial court has this case, and he's got the trial attorney in this case, and all he can judge him on is what he is doing in this case. And he has to control his courtroom, and he also has to protect the parties, both the parties who hired that out-of-state attorney and the parties who are on the other side, so that fair procedures are used, so that the orders of the court are followed. And yes, it may require at some point that in this case, your actions are such that the only way I can do that is you can't practice before me. But that doesn't mean that is inherent in the disparate situation that an in-state attorney finds and that an out-of-state attorney finds. And there is no way he's ever going to correct that situation by making a referral to the attorney's home state for conduct, because he's dealing with a trial. We're in the third day of trial. He's got to do something. And I think those issues are of in-state and out-of-state, is they are by their very nature going to have different rules and different procedures. And the responsible thing is to look at whether or not that attorney had a right or had the ability to explain to the judge why he did what he did. And in this case, that ability was given to him by Judge Gibbs over a number of hours in the middle of this trial.
Doesn't that presuppose that the judge has announced what he or she is considering doing? I mean, and how do we reconcile what happened in this case with the Anderson case and the rules for summary contempt, both of which impose an obligation on the trial court to announce what he or she is about to do and give the person who's going to be subjected to that governmental action a right to say something before it's taken?
Yeah, my point is he said everything, number one. He said everything he could say to justify his actions. Number two is this judge, gave him a lot of notice about what he was thinking of doing if all you had to do was read between the lines. He said, your actions are repulsive, unbelievable, reprehensible. It makes me sick for your clients. All right? Believe me, if you had been sitting in that courtroom, you knew exactly how the judge felt about what Mr. Foreman was doing on that day. And there is no doubt in my mind that he realized he was on very shaky grounds, so shaky that he himself was suggesting to the court a mistrial and assessing costs against himself. That's really all I have. Thank you.
Well, I have a question for you. As you probably know, there is a significant movement across the country, and the American Bar Association is now considering this issue, as is the Conference of Chief Justices, that we have what is known as reauthorize multi-jurisdictional practice. As you know, counsel are moving across the state. When I started practice, it was rare for an attorney to move out of his or her county. Now we have many attorneys who practice in several counties in the state. Now, and it was rare that the lawyers moved outside the state for practice. Now lawyers appear in many states, and the movement seems to be quite strong that something has to be done with the way we deal with practice, that we handle that. So how do you see this case fit into that multi-jurisdictional issue?
Well, I think the problem is trying to deal with a multi-jurisdictional issue on a very narrow kind of situation. What I would hope, and I'm certainly not opposed to a multi-jurisdictional practice, but I would hope that along with it goes a policing setup so that you don't get into situations like this where you say, what do I do? I'm a trial judge in Elkhorn. I've got what I believe is an attorney who's taking advantage of me and taking advantage of the other side, and this is my only option to maintain control. I would hope that when, if that is approved and it goes into effect, that we have a multi-jurisdictional licensing body of some sort, so that in fact there is a that attorneys can be treated the same. In other words, they are like, it's like having a license to practice in those other states, not just the, you know, there's a reason why the rule says in a pro hoc vice is that you're associated with a local attorney, so that we have someone there who is familiar with the rules and things like this, because we don't require taking the bar exam or being intimately familiar with that. If you have a multi-jurisdictional practice, I think the important thing is that the procedures go along with it, or the structure to police, to protect the public go along with it.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Gutglass?
Thank you, Your Honors. I'm James Gutglass of Gutglass Erickson Bonneville, and I represent, in this case, the Wisconsin Patients Compensation Fund. I'm going to try to touch on some of the things that were not directly covered by Attorney Swanson in his presentation. I think that in our case, which is a little different from the prior case, The main issue is whether it was error for the trial court to, on its own motion, revoke the pro hoc vice admission without a formal notice or hearing when the court has observed the conduct, allowed Mr. Foreman the chance to explain his conduct, and concluded the conduct was reprehensible and unbelievable. I think that notice provisions do not have to be formal in a case of pro hoc vice. The case law that has been discussed and that's been filed reflects that there is not a constitutional right. It's a privilege. Mr. Foreman was advised by the court that the conduct involved was extremely concerning. He was given multiple opportunities to explain what happened, and he should have been put on notice in a flexible looking at the record here that the judge was looking at serious sanctions, whether it be mistrial or revocation of his pro hoc vici, because of how he described his upsetness. The judge let Mr. Foreman know that his whole prior attitude in the litigation was upsetting to the court, that his behavior was repulsive, and Mr. Foreman knew or should have known that his pro hoc vici standing was in jeopardy.
Were those things said before lunch or after lunch?
At this moment, I don't recall. I know that the judge expressed his displeasure with what had happened quite clearly before lunch. What words were used before and after lunch, I'm not recalling specifically. I think the record reflects that both before and after lunch, he knew the judge was upset, and he knew why the judge was upset. And the reasons specifically that the judge was upset, in a little more detail, is that this witness had been deposed by the defense, and I specifically told the witness and Mr. Foreman near the end of the deposition, because of his inability to give opinions to a reasonable degree of medical probability, because he had not looked at the depositions of the defendants, plural, there were two physicians who were being sued, had not reviewed the medical records involved in the labor and delivery, that he wasn't in a position as a scientist and physician, or words to that effect, I think, to give an opinion to a reasonable degree of medical probability unless he saw those materials. And I said to Mr. Foreman, let's put all our cards on the table here. If you're going to send him things, you know, this is important, and we were going to want to do something about it. In Wisconsin, we don't want to be surprised. Sometimes we ask for relief. Sometimes we ask for another deposition of the witness. And Mr. Foreman was put on notice right then as to what needed to be done. And there was no indication to the defense that he wasn't going to. Observation by us at the deposition. And then what we had happening was the doctor came in and started to give objectionable testimony. It was surprising. It was not consistent with his deposition testimony. We went in off the record in chambers and had a discussion with the judge. The judge witnessed this, heard Mr. Foreman indicate that he had not been sent any of these materials that had been in existence prior to the deposition, since the deposition to the witness, and then the judge learned when we voir dired the witness that he had in fact been sent 3 weeks or so before the trial all of these materials that were critical to whether he could form an opinion to the requisite legal standard about causation against the remaining defendants in the case, which at that point were the Wisconsin Patients Compensation Fund, my client, and Mr. Swanson's client, Dr. McPherson. There had been a dismissal slash settlement agreement with respect to the other Dr. McHugh, who was no longer in the case. So this all became very critical to how we defended the case, and I think that it's critical to why the judge was upset, because he knew and had been kept apprised of what the developments were and knew that this had to be dealt with. And not once Could Mr. Foreman explain satisfactorily to the judge what had happened, why what he told him was incorrect, and why this witness had now changed his opinion and we weren't notified in advance?
Counsel, yes. I just want to clarify. If I missed it, I apologize to you. Is your position that there is a need for notice, but he had it? Or is your position that there's no need for notice?
I think that there is a need for notice, that the judge in the case considers what you have done to be a serious breach of an order, a serious misconduct, and that in this case, although the judge did not spell it out for him as reflected in the Assistant Attorney General's brief, that I'm considering revoking your license, I think any reasonable attorney in the same or similar situation would have been on notice as pro hoc vici, that if I've done repulsive, upsetting, unbelievable activity to this judge, that the judge is going to be considering revoking my license, and that's what, or my pro hoc vici privilege, and that's what's at issue at this point.
Why couldn't the judge just as easily revert into a contempt proceeding?
Well, I think he could have. I think he could have done a number of things. What he chose to do, apparently, on his own motion, was after thinking this through some more, and after having heard Mr. Foreman and the other counsel discuss the nature of what had occurred, he thought the proper sanction was available to him under the Supreme Court rules, and he exercised it.
This.
Okay. And I think under the Supreme Court rule, as we've already discussed, that Judge Gibbs had the authority to withdraw the privilege of Mr. Foreman to appear in this action. The case law that's been cited in the briefs supports this. And I don't think it would be appropriate to remand this back to the court and have a new judge assigned to this who wasn't privy to what was going on and observing the conduct. That,
why not, counsel? I know we have the Bacon Bar rule, which is in a domestic divorce situation. It goes back to the same judge, but I asked opposing counsel the question of substitution. Are you suggesting that if this would go back, that it should go to Judge Gibbs?
I'm saying that I don't think this should be remanded for a hearing. I think that Mr. Foreman had his hearing. I think that the appellants would love to have this go back to a different judge so that they have a better chance of getting the relief that they want than they're going to have with the judge that witnessed this behavior firsthand.
If this did go back, are you suggesting that, or are you agreeing with counsel that it should be another judge rather than Judge Gibbs?
I think that it has to go to a different judge if it goes back.
Counsel, you, in response to a question from the chief, said, yeah, it's your position that notice is necessary, but there was notice. What legal authority compels you to state that notice is legally necessary in this case?
Well, in looking at the case that's already been cited, this Johnson versus Trueblood case from the U.S. Court of Appeals, Third Circuit, the court discussed what procedure should be used where a district court seeks to revoke pro hoc vici status. And I don't think the opinion indicated that you needed to have formal notice, but they talked about some type of notice and an opportunity to respond would be necessary.
That leads me to my, I guess, next question, and maybe you've answered it by referencing the Trueblood case. That was based on policy as opposed to due process.
Right.
And that's where you would find some legal basis for this court's opinion?
That's, from the review of the cases, that's the only policy was what was come up with, because I think the cases cited said that there was no constitutional right for a lawyer such as Mr. Foreman to have due process hearing, but the True Blood Court talked about that it would be good policy under the circumstance to do something like that, and our contention is that he had notice of a serious problem, should have known the consequences of his action and how upset the judge was, got the opportunity repeatedly to explain his conduct. It wasn't a satisfactory explanation. There's been no explanation that's been given that's been satisfactory in the briefing or in the record for what occurred. And I think that the judge's decision was should be upheld because of what we just covered, that the notice was satisfactory and that the opportunity to address the concerns of the court were there, and he had an opportunity to be heard. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gutglass. Mr. O'Neill, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Interestingly, when talking about whether Mr. Foreman was on notice that his pro hoc vice status was at issue, the language used by Mr. Gutglass was as follows. He should have been put on notice that that status was at issue. We couldn't agree more. But the fact is that when you are talking about notice of depriving somebody of a right, or you are talking about notice of exercising authority under the Supreme Court's rules that have a set forth standard, you don't base it on an assumption of what he might or might have not gleaned from the proceedings. You do it by telling him what's coming and allowing him to answer based upon the appropriate standard. There were questions presented to counsel for the defendants about what was the basis of the court's opinion to take away the pro hoc vice status. We don't know. It's not set forth in the court's sua sponte, two-page opinion that just simply followed the language of the statute. Now, they've stood up here and said, we were there, we know how awful it was, and this and that happened. But they don't know precisely what conduct it was that led to that decision. Sure, they know the conduct that led to the decision on a mistrial. They know what the conduct was that led to the decision to impose sanctions. But they don't know precisely what the courts considered when deciding whether to revoke the pro hoc vice status. And they certainly don't know and can only guess whether the court made any attempt to consider the interests of the Jensens in keeping Mr. Foreman in the case. Because they want him in the case, but that issue did not come up in this discussion. There was some...
Could I ask a question?
Yes.
Is removal of a pro hoc vice attorney inevitably linked to a mistrial?
No. Sorry. Not at all. It's linked to a finding under this court's rule that an attorney has manifested incompetence to represent his clients or has shown an unwillingness to abide by either our rules of professional responsibility or the court's rules. So that doesn't have to be a mistrial.
If it is not linked to a mistrial, how do your proposed requirements for written notice, explanation of why someone should be removed and transferred to another judge, how does it square with an ongoing trial?
In an ongoing trial, I would agree, Your Honor, there may be instances where notice from the bench could be appropriate. Nonetheless, that notice has to instruct you that your pro hoc vice status is at issue. It has to give you, then followed up with that, a meaningful opportunity to be heard on that issue. If it happens in an ongoing trial, you don't need to declare a mistrial. You can take a break from the trial. You can have a day or two of hearings on that issue. It probably wouldn't take more than a day. With respect to it going for a new judge, I'm not advocating that that should be a blanket rule under 10.034. Absolutely not. But we contend that in this case, where the judge has already made the decision, and in light of the policy of Wisconsin set forth in 801.58 sub 7 and recognized by this court in Findorf, that this has to be decided by a different judge than Judge Gibbs. And it's been conceded we have that right. Mr. Gutglass stood up here and said he agrees. If there's another hearing, it's got to go to a different judge.
Well, as a matter of an order from this court or as a matter of you exercising your substitution. That's what the Findors had to do with, right?
Correct. And I would contend in this case it would be by order of this court. And I'll add one reason to that, and that is when you file for substitution, that request goes to that trial court judge. And that trial court judge has certain rights or non-rights to do it. And in fact, in a case that was decided by this court last summer, we exercised that right in the Jandert case and then waited 8 months for that court to agree to allow the substitution. And I don't think that the Jensens should be faced with the possibility of any delay, any further delay of their case.
The discretion of a trial judge to act on a substitution request is limited to matters of form, and there are time limitations that apply to it. Otherwise, it's kicked right to the chief judge. Isn't that how it works?
I agree that's how it works, but that is apparently not how it worked in our case. There was an objection lodged, and the court said, in light of the objection, I want briefing. We briefed it. That put the time limits off, and we waited 8 months for it.
But that's not universally how it's supposed to work.
I agree it's not how it's supposed to work. And I agree that we have a right to exercise it. I just think in this case, to avoid any possible complications, and in light of the record, it should be an order of this court that it goes to a different judge. Further statements about the basis of the court's opinion, I believe we were asked to either read between the lines or base it upon what any reasonable attorney would know. And I think at a minimum, whether it's in writing, whether it's oral, I think this court has to order that when your pro hoc vitae status is at issue, you have to be told that and nothing else. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. O'Neill. Thank you, Mr. Gutglass and Mr. McCracken. That concludes our hearing on 99-2774. The court will be in recess until 1:45. The students who are here, plus the